After the war, the Communist Party, again, it wasn't really sure what it was going to do. The original idea was that they would favour the continuation of the wartime coalition. It had seemed to work. But after, very shortly before, slightly after the general election, 1945, they became a very loyal supporter of the Labour government. It's because they were actually doing something, as opposed to most of the Labour governments, which have not done anything. So this was, I think, actually, I mean, I said that, there were, the party was kind of, the Communist Party was at its heights during the war. But in numbers, that might be true. But I think afterwards, this was when they were kind of actually doing something. And this was when their, I think their prime time was. I've got a couple of things here, again from the Daily Worker and again from Mr. Armitage. It's from his father, who was also called Andy Armitage. This is the first edition of the Daily Worker, which was issued from their brand new, spanking new headquarters, which were in Farringdon Road, which was just up the road, incidentally. I like left places. And it was almost exactly opposite where William Morris had met when he'd formed his Communist League. Yes, Communist League. Is it Communist League?
Socialist League.
Why am I thinking Communist League? I've got communists on the mind. But anyway, it was almost directly opposite there. It's now, well, it isn't now, because I've seen it written that their old Daily Worker building is now a sushi bar. But it's not, because it was unstable. It was an interesting building. Oh, I'm going on about my buildings. But the upper parts of it were new, but the lower parts of it were old. And essentially it was a bombed building. And the lower parts were actually unstable, and they had to pull it down after the Daily Worker had moved out. So the sushi bar, which you can see there, is not the Daily Worker building. That's me being very pedantic. But those Daily Worker. Oh, actually, I'll give you the bits which go with it. The Daily Worker wasn't actually directly connected. It wasn't an organisational thing of the Communist Party. It was actually owned by the People's Press Printing Society Limited, and it still is. This is a booklet of their rules, and this is a membership card, membership share card. You can actually still invest it. This is for £5 from 1946. It's never been withdrawn. It is actually worth money. I don't know if you could actually use the shares to reclaim them, but you could if you wanted to, perhaps. Anyway, one of the things I should say is that about our press, we've always rejected the idea of having a subsidiary organisation, a sort of front, if you like, to issue it. And that was one of the things which was laid down in 1904. It was actually quite an important point of the party's formation. And the Socialist Standard is owned by the party. It's not owned separately. And obviously this lets us in for problems if anyone is rude. If anyone's rude and there's a law case against us, we'll be going bankrupt if it's too bad. The people who have been brought up, incidentally, is my missus. She's a trustee, and I understand that if there is any kerfuffle in this way, she'll be put in jail. So she's responsible. You can write whatever you like if you want, because I can get the house then, and I'll be very upset. Anyway, there you go. This is a bunch of Daily Worker things. It's I think that's true. And it's also incidentally, it's quite interesting because it's like I was saying about the carrying on the traditions of the British Socialist Party. This is another tradition. It's carried over because the SDF or BSP's things, they were all issued by something called the 20th Century Press Limited. And that was their front one. Again, what they had, which was quite interesting, what happened there. And another reason why we always say the party press should be controlled by the party is because their ones, they actually were controlled separately. And this let them in for a organisational dispute, because when Hindman split out off, obviously being a rich man, he controlled the press and he took the BSP's press with him. And they were left at a bit of a loose end. Which is so, never trust rich people. Anyway, so I come to the 1950s, and this was a fairly interesting It's not a fairly interesting time. Nobody interested in the 50s and 60s, which is a bit of a shame, because that's when the Communist Party was actually, it was very stable in the 50s and 60s. There were all these things that happened to it, all these things which you'd think would affect them. There was a ballot rigging scandal, a Communist Party member, not actually, wasn't on Communist Party orders, but he was responsible for a ballot rigging in the Electrical Trade Union. And, you know, so there was a scandal there. There was obviously Hungary, and there was several other things. But essentially, they were very stable in the 50s and 60s. They kept their numbers, and even Hungary, although they lost a lot of people, maybe 8,000, they made them up within a few years. But the 1950s were set off by this thing here, the British Red Socialist. This is the original edition of it. It's still issued by the Communist Party of Britain these days. The British Red Socialism is there. It's nice. It's a very nice thing. It doesn't say anything about insurrection. It says nothing about... It's all about the broad coalition of all these things. It's a Popular Front thing. It doesn't have anything about the Soviets in it. We don't like those. We're trying to be nice and attract people. This is British Red Socialism. It had a name. It was called the Pink. It's the Pinky. There you go. It had a name for it, which I can't remember. And, of course, during the 50s... This is another pamphlet from the 50s. One of the things they didn't do in the 1950s, and they dropped as part of the Popular Front things, they didn't call it the Popular Front in the 50s, was they dropped the idea of fronts altogether, because they didn't work, because the Labour Party particularly didn't like anyone associating with communists. It would ban them and say, if you're a member of this, you're not au fait with us. But one of the ones which they did set up in the 50s was the Peace Councils. They were almost the only people in the 1950s who were proposing nuclear weapons, I mean, as an organisation. This is from Jack Bradley's collection. I've got enormous amounts of stuff from Jack Bradley, and this is one of them. He was very interested in the 50s, in anti-war movement, because he was a nice guy with Jack Bradley. I liked him. And... this is a rather nice one. It says, if it fell on Hampstead. And I've no idea why they picked on Hampstead, but it's quite a nice thing. I suppose it's because it's the Hampstead Peace Council. It's a local one. It's a local movement. I don't know if it was banned by the Labour Party, but I would very much suspect it was. And, of course, the big thing, as I've said before, in the 50s, was Hungary. And this was... A lot of people left over Hungary, as you might expect. And the people who were very, I suppose you would call the leaders of it, they were the only people I know I've actually heard of who were involved in it, were John Saville and E.P. Thompson. And they issued this thing, The Reasoner. There was already movements in the party against the climate of, anti-democratic climate within the party, its internal structure. And they started off with this, but they moved on to Hungary, and that really put it in for them. This is The Reasoner. This is the thing that was issued by John Saville, E.P. Thompson. It's quite rare. And it's on the back, you'll notice that John Saville is actually living in Hull. I used to live in Hull, and I used to live off Westbourne Avenue. Westbourne Avenue was the next one along. And he still lived in Westbourne Avenue. When I knew him, I didn't know him very well, because he didn't like anyone who wasn't an intellectual, so far as I could tell. He certainly didn't like me, because I introduced myself to him and he said, something like that. It was definitely a grunt. He was definitely not interested in knowing me, and he should have been rather interested in knowing my missus, because one of the things that John Saville did later was the Dictionary of Labour Biography. I mentioned this already, and my missus actually did an entry in that for the Dictionary of Labour Biography, and she said he grunted at her too. So we were obviously not in his league there, I think. But that's The Reasoner. And this was the thing that the opposition in the Communist Party focused around. When it left, there was a lot of people that did leave. They tried to organise themselves around what became, because The Reasoner evolved by the New Reasoner into this, the New Left Review. And they tried to form something called the Left Clubs, which was based, on, I suppose, on the idea of the Left Book Clubs in the 1930s. It was basically, it was the idea that you don't have a party. It's a non-party thing. They tried to set it up. It lasted a couple of years, and then it went bankrupt, basically. The New Left Review still exists, but again, it's one of these organisations that's only it's only interested in intellectuals. And I think that this is the one of the greatest crimes against socialism is making it into an intellectual academic stream. I think this is absolutely outrageous. This is worse than anything I've ever heard from the left. But there you go, because I don't like intellectuals, because I'm a bit of a workerist geezer. 1950s and 60s, as I said, they were quite good times for the Communist Party, but they weren't very interesting times. This is an issue of a fairly typical thing. It's actually quite interesting because the pamphlets are very boring compared to the 1930s. This is Marxism Today. It's mentioning Hungary, which is probably better not done. And this is Challenge. This is the youth. This is the, I should say, it's a theoretical organ. And this is organ. This sounds awful, doesn't it? And Challenge is the youth paper. And although this one's got a picture of some children on it, again, it's not a very interesting layout. It's not very lively. It's worth passing them. And one of the reactions, of course, to this was breakaways. One of the breakaways focused on people who said, unlike the people like E.P. Thompson and John Saville, who said this party is too Stalinist, these guys thought the party was not Stalinist enough. And this is the Maoists. I have quite a lot of stuff. There's quite a lot of nice things here. The original people who broke up, they were not ever so lively. This is the Committee to Defeat Revisionism for Communist Unity. It was the first pro-China, anti-Russia one. Basically, they focused on this. They said that Russia wasn't Stalinist enough, but China was. This is Vanguard. It's not a very interesting one, but they got in more interesting later, and you'll like this one. This is Hammer or Anvil. This is the Marxist-Leninist Unity one. I should incidentally, I completely forgot about my handouts, because if you look on those, you'll be able to identify where all these people fit on these. I should have probably said that to start with, shouldn't I? This is Hammer and Anvil, and you can see that compared to the Communist Party publications of the day, this was pretty lively. You could see why young people especially would be attracted to this. This has got Chairman Miao on here, and it's got your revolutionary Chinese people, probably actually Vietnamese by the look of them. It's 1966. They're kicking bottom, I think you might say there. One of the other organisations, the Maoist organisations then, was the British and Irish Communist Organisation. This was quite prominent in its day, but it was quite a weird one. I think basically they were very similar sorts of people, and nowadays they're not called Maoists. The way you recognise them, incidentally, is by the Marxist-Leninist little thing there. That's how you can tell. But they're not called Marxist. They don't like to call themselves Maoists, and they're not Maoists anymore, by and large. What they are nowadays is they call themselves anti-revisionists. They've gone for a variety of different things. They've changed from back in Russia, I said to the start with, then to be Maoists back in China, through Hoxha mostly, which is Albania, and basically nowadays I think they're all backing North Korea, which they call the DPRK. Fair enough. Good on you. And this is perhaps the longest. Again, they seem to go for very long titles, the Maoist guys. This is the Workers' Institute of Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong Thought, based in Brixton, which is down the road. It's from 1980. And it's quite a nice little thing again. It's got Chairman Mao on it. And like I say, none of them are actually Maoists these days. That's me Maoists. They're still around, but like I say, they're not, generally speaking, they're not Maoists anymore. The British and Irish Communist Organisation was a very, very odd one. And this is the end of the comments, but I'm beginning. This is the beginning of the end, which I think you'll probably be grateful for. Right, 1968. In my opinion, and I've started off saying that the Communist Party was set up. It was set up on the initiative of the Comintern. It was to unite all the communists in Britain, and it was for Russia. It was for the Soviet Union. It was designed to support them. This is why I'm wearing my British-Soviet Friendship Society badge. This is not my badge. It is my badge. But I don't believe in it. I'm just wearing it so you will note that it is Britain and Russia together. And this was what the purpose of the Communist Party was for. It was to support Russia, support the Soviet Union. And 1968, we have Czechoslovakia. They're worried in 1968 that the same thing's going to happen to them again. Basically, they've got cold feet, because, as I've said before, they made up the numbers, but they don't want it to happen again, so they issue a little thing that says it deeply deplores the military intervention in Czechoslovakia, which is like, hang on, you're not supporting the Soviet Union here, so what's the point of you? What is the point of the Communist Party after this point? I say that this is the Communist Party's suicide note. That's what I say. I said this is from 1968. That is the Communist Party's suicide. It's a nice little document, that, I think. And even though, I mean, you've heard of Eurocommunism. This was the biggest big thing. It was supposedly the Euros versus the tankies. This was how the Communist Party died. I think most people in the Communist Party were not Euros and they were not tankies. They were not one thing or the other. And I think a lot of them did not know what the hell was going on, and they were very, very upset about it all. Because it was a lot of the people had joined during the war, and they'd invested a lot of their time and effort into something that was now being ripped apart by factional fighting. And they didn't know which one to take, which is why, when it came to the end of it, you add up the numbers and you think, there's 1,000 here and 1,000 there, and where is that 20, 30,000 coming from? Or going to, and it's going nowhere. Anyway, Eurocommunism, I should explain. Eurocommunism was the idea that you don't have to be supportive of the Eastern Bloc. And it didn't come as a word until 1975. But as I've said with 1968, they're actually practicing it a lot earlier than that. And there's a rather nice pamphlet from these times that I've got here, which has nothing to do with it, incidentally, but they're rather trying to reinvent themselves. And you've had the rather boring ones from the early 60s, and this is a rather nice one, which is, it's a hippie, doody one. We're in with it. We're not tankies. We're not into Stalin. We're friendly young people. This is, again, it's from Jack Bradley's collection, and he writes on his pamphlet. It's quite funny because I always read what he's written, and he'll probably be quite thrilled with that. There's actually a reference to the party on it, and it's in here. It's the party is in here, and it says, basically, we're Trotskyists. We just like those Trotskyists. How dare you? Trotskyists again. But they're not calling us fascists this time, and not trying to destroy us like vipers. Anyway, there was a lot of people who... Although I've said before, essentially, during the 1950s and 60s, they were into this Popular Front by another name. It was all getting too much for a lot of people. They split off. New Communist Party, 1977. This was a... I'm afraid I haven't got anything from them. I was quite upset that I didn't have anything from them. Basically, they broke off in 1977, and this was the first substantial split the Communist Party had ever had. I mean, ever in its whole history, which is why on my sheet I haven't done like a really massive... chart, because it was like there's some people coming together at the beginning and they're all splitting up at the end, but you know there's nothing. Nobody's if they split off, they split off as individuals, don't form groups. And the New Communist Party split off in 1977, and again it was a split because they thought it wasn't being Stalinist enough. They're based actually near Clapham Junction. Again, another, it must be South London. I don't know what it is. But they're over this way. Right, so basically, what you had was, you had the Euros versus the tankies. Again, I'm using those words. It's certain things there. And the next thing was that the industrial wing broke off. This is the Communist Party of Britain. In my view, it's the trade union wing of the old Communist Party. They're very into trade unions. Went to one of their meetings. It was supposed to be about the People's Assembly, but really what they wanted to talk about was their trade union activity and what they were doing in the trade unions, which I thought, well, you know, that's fair enough, but it's supposed to be about the People's Assembly, so I want to know what your view is upon them. And they didn't really, to be honest, have much of a view. Anyway, the Euros actually went quite far here because they actually, weirdly enough, I mean, I find them quite offensive because they actually belittled the unions. Now, one of them, the people in Marxism Today, wrote an article which said unions are collapsing, they're rubbish, our unions, and he said that officials were indulging in perks and fiddles. And that's like, I just think that's outrageous, and understandably, the people on the Morning Star did too. And the Communist Party of Britain, basically, we made a big fuss about it, which we were quite right to do so, got expelled, and eventually went on to form the Communist Party of Britain in 1988. After that, they weren't just Eurocommunists. I had no idea what they were, because they were so weird. I mean, I find it a very odd organisation in the... I've missed that one. That's a shame. A very odd organisation in the late 80s, early 90s. Basically, I don't know what it would be. This is the Eurocommunists who have gone far beyond anything like this. They've gone beyond communism, socialism, anything like that. I mean, it was into the realms of weird fantasy stuff. And this is their thing called Manifesto for New Times. They issued it in 1988. I think it's post-structuralist. In other words, it's intellectual, it's posturing, it's obscurantist. It's dreadful, dreadful thing. And they actually said this is a strategy for the 90s. Well, of course, it wasn't. And nobody wanted them, and they drifted away. I actually think, when you look at the front of this, it actually looks like they're on fairly strong drugs for this. Because this is like, I've no idea what these guys are. This is LSD or something like that. It's very, very weird. And the whole thing of it is very weird if you look at it. It's very closely written as well, which is, again, something which I've found about all the communist things. It's very closely written, very dense, but essentially it's weird. But there you go. And what they eventually did, of course, is they became the democratic left. And this is... I haven't had asides about party members for a while, but this is about me and the democratic left. And in the 90s, I didn't know about politics. I was a bit ignorant. And I had vaguely heard of the Democratic Left. And I went along, I walked around London a lot, and I walked up somewhere called Pentonville Road. It's a very long road. And off there is this little side turning called Cynthia Street. I thought, that's a funny little name. And I went along, it's quite a nice little sign turning. And down there was the Democratic Left. It was their headquarters, it had a plaque on the door. So I thought, being a bit ignorant, I thought, I wonder what that is. So it was obviously some sort of lefty group. So I pressed their buzzer. It was during the day, so there was someone there. And there was someone there. I could hear them. I could hear them moving about. And I could hear them laughing in there. They were laughing at me. They were looking out the window and laughing at me. And I thought, bloody hell. No, I didn't have a hat in those days. I had hair in those days. And they were looking at and laughing at me. Whether they thought I was Trotsky, come to reclaim his ice pick, I don't know. But they were laughing and they were listening to experimental jazz. And so what I think, this is what my theory about what happened to the £5 million which the Democratic Left had inherited. I think they spent that money on weird drugs to laugh with and experimental jazz records. Very odd organisation. Basically, what they are, and this, of course, is what my final bit is. If you were here last year, this is the best bit. This is the thing I enjoyed the most about preparing for it, was actually getting stuff, paper about the various different organisations. And I should say about the Democratic Left is that it's disappeared. What it is now, it's something called Unlock Democracy. Nobody has ever heard of this. And considering that this is the legal successor of an organisation which everyone had heard of, probably everyone in the whole country had heard of, nobody knows what... Basically, it's supposedly a pro-democratic, pro-democracy... It was in favour of all these rubbishy democratic things that had recently about alternative votes and things like that. It was in favour of those. It pressed for those a bit, but nobody had ever heard of them. Certainly, nobody had ever heard of them. Received any propaganda from them?
I have actually.
Have you?
Yes, because I teach politics so occasionally.
Oh, do you?
Across the website, I thought they would be then really an option.
Yeah, they're certainly not.
The House of Lords.
Yeah. It's But anyway, what I can certainly say about them is that they have arranged for nice little jobs for all of them. Nice little jobs for all of the people who were the leadership in the old party at its end. And they're very well set up. Thank you very much. I've got something to do. You know, nobody's ever heard of them, but whatever. They're doing something that they're certainly receiving a nice little income. I'm not very fond of the Democratic Left because they laughed at me. And they probably laughed at my beard. And they would certainly laugh at my hat. Right. The oldest currently existing communist parties in Britain are the remains of these Maoist groups from the 60s. They're all, again, you'll notice that they're all called Marxist-Leninist. They're not called Maoist. They're not Maoist anymore. Haven't been for a long time. They are pro-North Korea, certainly. They're quite different. I mean, we joke about the, Judean People's Front and everything like that. And the names are very similar, but they're very distinctive groups. And they're basically... I've got three here. They're the three existing ones. They're on the little sheet of anti-provisionist people. This is the Revolutionary Communist Party of Britain, Marxist-Leninist. It's coloured. It's quite a nice publication. They're quite enthusiastic people. They have a shop called John Buckle Centre, which is that way. I went to visit her today, and I met their leader. He was a nice man. I shook hands with him and things like that. It was nice. It was a bit like our head office here, actually, except for the front had been ruled off here, and the lounge was here, and it was incredibly hot. You think it's hot here? I was actually baking in this place. I was sweating. Oh God, it's so hot. Oh, love you. Are you trying to sweat Stalinism out of me? I'll give these around at the time. The other one, which is basically, yes, this dates back to the 60s, but not in its original name. This, on the other hand, has been around since 1968. This is the industrial ones. These were the old student ones. They're quite enthusiastic. This is the industrial ones. I met two of these guys giving out these on a demonstration somewhere. They were very grey, trade union-looking types. They did not look enthusiastic. They're apparently renowned. It's the Communist Party of Britain, Marxist-Leninist. They're apparently renowned for their nationalist overtones, so I've been told. And in fact, it does actually, if you look through their stuff, it is quite alarmingly nationalist. I was quite alarmed by those guys, actually. And this is the other anti-revisionist group that's currently around. It's the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist. This is the... people called, they were associated with a fellow called Harpal Bra. They're very strident. It's quite an alarming thing, but for a different reason. They're very pro a lot of different groups abroad. Their bits that they hand out are quite alarming. I think it's the language that they use is also quite interesting. It's not really the sort of stuff that ordinary English people, I think, really can appreciate. And I think that's because they've got a very high degree of Indian origin people in them. And it's quite alarming, anyway. And it's a bit different. It's something that's not quite au fait with me. And I think probably other people react to them when they're given it. This is the New Worker. This is the New Communist Party, formed in 1977. I actually quite like this because, like I say, I'm not really much of an intellectual. I liked The New Worker because it seemed to be aimed at people like me. There's not very many people like me around anymore, I don't think. But I quite liked it. And I was quite surprised at how much it resembled, in some ways, the Socialist Standard. It's got editorials on the front page there, and it's the only one also, the only party of the whole left that I know that's got a 20 years ago column, or, you know, a retrospective items column. I don't know anyone else who's got one of those. Again, it's a similar thing to the Socialist Standard in some ways. Obviously, it's different in our forms. But there you go. What other things? Oh, it's got a short items column, which also we have in the Standard, which theirs is called Say No More. And this is very much resembling the one on the back of the Standard, which I can't remember what it's called anymore. It's the short items column. What's it called?
Voice from the Back.
Yes, Voice from the Back.
Imitated, yeah.
Yeah. And is there a connection there, do you think?
They copied it.
I could have done it. Oh, it's quite possible. Right, well, that's the new Communist Party, incidentally, has got quite close links to the Maoists. They're quite on the same wavelength. Apparently, they do. I'm not saying that they do joint meetings, but they're quite... although they've got different origins, they're quite close. This is the Weekly Worker. I think it's the only one of all of these that I've ever found in head office. People in the party seem to like it. It's known as the gossip column of the left, I believe. I'm not sure who it is who brings it in here. Personally, it's one that I can't bear. It's because it's got internal left politics in it. It's almost obsessed with it. And I'm not actually. I mean, I like the history, and I'm interested in different left groups and the history and where they are and things like that. But the internal politics of it, it's not really my cup of tea. But nonetheless, some people in the party seem to be interested in it. They seem to read it. They call themselves the Communist Party of Great Britain. They used to be called the Communist Party of Great Britain Provisional Central Committee. All the old people in the Communist Party who I've talked to, they didn't really like them very much. They seem to have some antipathy to them. Probably because it's probably the name. Because these guys are around 50 strong, probably even less. They're the size of one of our big branches. They're about the size of Manchester branch, but they're a bit more active. Anyway, there's the Communist Party of Great Britain. They've actually, says here, the Communist Party of the European Union. Which is what they're aiming towards, which is it's an interesting perspective that you could form an international communist party within the European Union. They're a relatively interesting group, but very small. And like I said, the old blokes are not very keen on them. Now, of course, the real successor to the Communist Party of Great Britain, and it's the people who generally have assumed it. They've got an organic tie to them. They number, for example, their conferences. When they hold a Congress, Communist Party of Britain, their congresses are, which is our conferences, they number theirs as if they're in the same series, as if they've started in 1920. They are a different organisation, but they keep the continuity going. And I think that there is a certain degree of it, because they're the guys who are associated with it. They don't own the Morning Star. Associated with it. And there you go, this is the Morning Star. I think we're all familiar with the Morning Star. I didn't get the Morning Star for a long time. I wouldn't touch it. And the reason why is because when I was a kid, I used to get all the lefty papers. I wasn't really political, but I used to get them. And I used to leave them around for my dad to read. And judging by what he said, or how he reacted, that was my judgment as to whether they were good guys or bad guys. And he liked the Morning Star. He was, I've got to say, he was a Nazi, my dad. He was a thoroughgoing, evil, bigoted man. Unlike most Nazis, he didn't dislike particularly black people, Asian people. He had it in for the Chinese. I just couldn't. I've never been able to figure out why he didn't like the Chinese, why he thought the Chinese were the worst people in the world, and why they were coming to this country It's just beyond me. Anyway, when I gave him a copy of the Morning Star, or if I left it around, his response was, "Oh, I like that paper. I like Uncle Joe." Whether this was because Uncle Joe killed people, and he liked Uncle Joe for this reason, I have absolutely no idea. But anyway, that's why I wouldn't touch the Morning Star for a long, long time, because my dad liked it. I'll probably put them in a section. This is their paper, the Communist. This is their theoretical paper, the Communist Review. I was saying that it's the industrial wing, and they weren't particularly into Stalin, but there is a little picture of Stalin on the top corner there. So obviously they are fairly into Stalin, but not, they don't usually mention him as a rule. The Communist Review, incidentally, again, I should say there's a lot of continuity here, because Communist Review was something I had earlier. It was something that the original Communist Party used. Here is a copy of Challenge. This is the Young Communist League. I don't know how many people in the Young Communist League, because the numbers of the Communist Party of Britain are about 900. I can't imagine there's very many people in the Young Communist League, but nonetheless, it still exists, it still operates, it still issues a party thing. It's quite a thing that might attract people. And this is the worst piece of nostalgia I've ever seen. If we're in Germany, we'd call it nostalgia. But I don't know if there needs to be a word for communist nostalgia. This is Country Standard. It says here it was founded in 1935, and this is volume 14, number 1. But it wasn't published for about 50 years. This is a revival. And this is trying to, get people in the countryside issued, to rope them in. It's a very weird thing, but it's not the longest revival, the longest hiatus, there's a nice word, between a revival and its original. That's The Black Dwarf, which was Tariq Ali's paper in the 60s, because he had actually taken the name Black Dwarf from a radical publication which ceased existing in 1820-ish. So they've not beaten the record there. But anyway, that's the Communist Party. I think it's kind of got a future. I went to one of their meetings, and I was quite surprised by how many young people were there. There was young people. There were not. It was pretty much the sort of levels that we get. We get young people, we get old people, we get middle people. And I was quite surprised that the historic. Considering that I'd actually only had their paper stuff, I was surprised how many were young people, were kind of people who didn't remember the old days, basically. So I was surprised about that, and I think probably they've got some sort of future on the left. They're, anyway, that's me lot. You'll be glad to know.